looking at Mark chapter 6, verses 45 to 56. That can be found on your page 1071 of the Pew Bible. Mark 6, 45 to 56. Jesus walks on the water. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountains to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astonished, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to whatever they heard he was, wherever he heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. Thanks be to God for the wording of his reading today.
For those of you who can't swim or you're afraid of drowning, I got the place for you. It's called the Dead Sea. It is not called the Dead Sea because many people have drowned there. It's called the Dead Sea because its salinity content, that is the amount of salt in it, stands at 33%. By comparison, the normal ocean, such as the Atlantic or the Indian or Pacific Ocean, has a salinity content of 3 to 5%. So the Dead Sea has 10 times as much amount of salt in it, and therefore no plant life, no fish, can live in it. And that's why it's called the Dead Sea. But because of this high salinity content, the great advantage for us is that you can float in it with very little effort, or if in any effort at all. But don't take my word for it. Listen to this man.
It is my first time at the Dead Sea, and it's an outstanding experience. To float in water, human body normally sinks in water. Here I was floating in water. What a feeling. Without having to expend any energy, I was floating in water. Outstanding. But the water hurts.
But this...
You can go on YouTube and check out other videos of people floating on the Dead Sea. So as I see, you see the picture there, that person's on their stomach. So how can you float in water with no effort like that? So it's very amazing to watch. But we can do one better than the Dead Sea, water that is so high in salt content that it keeps you afloat. In terms of an anti-drowning measure, we can do better than that. How about walking on the water? Our text this morning shows that Jesus walked on the water, and not just a calm lake, and he wasn't, as sometimes some smart aleck will say, "Well, I can walk on water too when it's ice." But he was walking on a rough sea. The wind was blowing, and he walked on the waves. Wow! Somebody's walking on water. Walking on water. For those of us who grew up in the church, we've heard this story many, many times. And we think, oh yes, yeah, I heard the story. Jesus walked on the water. Ho-hum. Next. And we need to break out of the contemptuous fog of familiarity if we're to grasp what God is trying to tell us. Folks, nobody walks on water. Which of the 6 billion humans on this earth can even walk on the top of a puddle? Nobody, none of us. And yet, this is what our text says. Jesus walked on the water. We should be absolutely astounded, flabbergasted, amazed. Just think, 2 chapters earlier in Mark chapter 4, verse 35 to 41, we saw Jesus was in the boat on the water with his disciples in the storm. He stood up and he spoke to the wind and the waves and calmed it. I mean, that's tremendous authority to be able to speak and make the water behave and the wind behave. But this takes Jesus up to the level here. He says, I'll show my authority over the water. I won't just speak to it, I'll walk on it. That's the ultimate anti-drowning measure. He physically shows his authority over water by walking on it. Now, before we can dive into the significance of Jesus walking on the water, we need to put it in its context. And the context was this feeding of the 5,000. In Mark chapter 6, verse 45, it informs us that Jesus purposefully sent the disciples away in the boat. He did that and told them to go without him. Why did he do that? The reason we saw from John chapter 6, verse 15 last week was because this crowd of the 5,000 plus that he fed was quite really revolutionary, having a revolutionary mindset. They were politically charged and ready to start a rebellion. So as John said in his gospel, they were going to come and make Jesus by force be their king, their guerrilla leader, their general, to start a war with Rome and the Herodians for political independence. So Jesus senses and knows the danger of the situation and the volatileness of the situation. So he says, I got to get my guys out of here. You get out on the boat. Go. And then he would dismiss the crowds. And then he goes alone to pray. He goes up into the hill, up into the mountain to pray by himself. And this is how he diffuses the situation. Now he goes to pray. He's doing that to strengthen himself, I think, against temptation. In the Gospel of Mark, there are 3 times when Jesus is mentioned to go away and pray alone by himself. And I think it is how he deals with the temptation to divert away from his mission for what he came, to be that suffering Messiah, that suffering servant, proclaiming the kingdom of God. In Mark chapter 1, verse 35, that was the first time. So Jesus had been healing in Capernaum, lots of people coming around for healing and miracles, and then he goes and he prays in the very early hours of the morning by himself. And finally, when the disciples find him, they say to him, hey, everybody's been looking for you. You know, you're the popular man. You're the man of the hour. Where are you? Why are you hiding up here? And Jesus' reply is, I must go and to other villages and proclaim the kingdom of God. This is why I came. So there's that temptation that he could just stay in Capernaum, please the crowd, be the popular guy doing the miracles and the healings. And he says, no, that's going to misdirect me from what I came for. I came to proclaim and bring in the kingdom of God, and I need to teach that in other villages. And then you have this text here, our today's text, where he leaves to pray right after these people have the idea and want to make him king. But it's not the type of kingship that Jesus is going to give or be. It's a very different type. He says, no, yeah, I'm a king, but I am not this type. And he resists the temptation to give in to fame and a kingship of the crowd that they would offer him. And then later, in Mark 14, the other passage, he retreats to pray in the garden just before he dies, to strengthen himself, to do the Father's will, and to submit fully to it. So he's been praying, and it says that this is at the third watch of the night, sometime between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. in the morning. He finishes his praying, and perhaps, I'm not sure how, maybe supernaturally, maybe not, he sees the disciples out on the boat, and he decides to go to them. They're not in danger of sinking, not like two chapters ago when they woke them up in the boat and they were afraid that they were going to sink and drown. Not this time, but they are losing a battle in their rowing with the strong wind that is blowing them off course. So he decides to go to them at the fourth watch of the night. And John chapter 6, verse 19 notes the disciples had rowed 3 or 4 miles. So he's got a little bit of a walk to see get to them. Now the curious thing here is that it says that when he saw them and he came to them, at the end of verse 48, it says he meant to pass by them. What does that mean, that Jesus meant to pass by them? It cannot mean that Jesus was showing off, that Jesus was going to walk by them and say, you know, jokingly say to them, suckers, I'll see you on the other side. You know, just keep going. Look how easy it is for me. That can't be why he intended to pass them by. Jesus, after all, had just fed a riotous, volatile crowd with bread and fish till they could eat, with all they could eat, and this crowd had interrupted his holiday. So he taught them and cared for them in a physical way, giving them bread and food. So, I mean, he won't be that cruel. He won't be playing a bad joke on his closest followers. So having seen the disciples struggling and rowing all night, getting for nowhere, he has compassion for them. So he goes to them. But what does he mean that he's going to pass them by? There are 3 clues from the Old Testament that perhaps give us an understanding of what's going on here. Clue number 1. Only God can walk on water or make paths through the sea. Job chapter 9, verse 8 refers to God, and I quote, "Who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea." And then you have Psalm 77, verses 16 and 9. "When the water saw you, O God, when the water saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen." So, characteristic of God is that he's the one who goes on or through the seas, and only he can do that. He can trample it. He can walk over it. Clue number 2, when God passed by someone, it was often to reveal himself to them, to tell them, show them something about himself. The more well-known case is Moses in Exodus 33 and 34. Moses has asked God, he says, "How can I know that myself and the nation, the Hebrews, how can we know we found favor in your sight?" God says, "All right, good question. I'll show you, or I'll give you an answer to that question, and this is how you may know you have found favor in my sight. I will pass by you, and you will see my goodness. You will see my grace." So you know the story where Moses is to go into a crevice of the rock. God says he'll put his hand over Moses, because he can't look at God's face. He says, "I'll put my hand over you, and then I will pass by you. Then I will remove my hand, and you can see the back. You can see my goodness. You can see my mercy. You can't see me in my full glory of who I am. You can only see this part of me. And this is how you'll know that you have my favor. And then there's another situation in 1 Kings 19 with Elijah. Elijah has ran to the mountain of God. Jezebel, the evil queen, had threatened to take his life. And he went to the mountain of God, and he was in a cave. And God said to Elijah, "Get out of the cave. I'm going to pass by." And so he goes out, and there's a wind. I think there's an earthquake, and there's a fire, but God isn't in those things. And then he hears the still small voice. God passes by in the still small voice and recommissions and strengthens Elijah and sends him back to do what God wants him to do. So there's this idea that when God passes by someone, it's to show something of himself, to reveal something. And then clue number three is the use of the divine name, I am. So you see that the disciples cry out in the night thinking it's a ghost, and Jesus says, "Take heart, it is I." Now, these words, "it is I," or "is ego e me" in the Greek, and those are the same words that are used in the Septuagint to translate the Hebrew name for God, I am, when God gave his name, I am who I am, to Moses. Now, it can mean that, or it can simply mean, it is I, and then you fill in the name of the blank of the person. Oh, it is I, Joe, or it is I, Grace, or I. But it also can stand for I am. Given the context of Jesus walking on the water and the statement in verse 52 that the disciples did not understand about the loaves and their hearts were hardened, a deeper meaning of Jesus announcing himself with the divine name can be intended for the disciples if they have ears to hear, and for us if we have ears to hear. So what in conclusion do these three clues point us to? What is it helping us understand or seeking to lead us to if, in terms of this phrase, pass them by? Well, in Job chapter 9, verse 8, Job's statement was only God could walk on or tread water. And he's describing various characteristics of God that only God can do or only God is. Then in verse 11, Job says, "Behold, he passes me by, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him." James Edwards writes, "But when Jesus passes by the disciples on the lake, he does something differently from the revelation of God in the Old Testament. He intends to make the mysterious, enigmatic God of Job visible, as it had not been and could not have been to the former generations. Jesus walking on the water to his disciples is a revelation of the glory that he shares with the Father and the compassion that extends to his followers." So simply put, Jesus walking by them on the water is meant to reveal something to his disciples if they have eyes to see, something about who he is and what his character is. In other words, that he's divine. That here, once again, Jesus is doing something that only God can do. And they should be able to learn to see that and recognize that. And that is the purpose of all of Jesus' miracles. That's the purpose of all of his statements, is to reveal that in him, God has come in the flesh. God has passed by. God has come near. But the trouble is, in Mark chapter 6, verses 14 to 56, with the crowds, is that they can't see that. All they see is a healer. All they see is a potential candidate for political revolution. The disciples, they don't know what to make of Jesus. They're all over the place. in their thinking about Jesus as you read the Gospels, often confused, often astounded, often frightened. The people in the region of Gennesaret in the closing verses of chapter 6, they primarily see Jesus as a miracle worker, as a healer. The emphasis there in that text is the people are continually bringing all the people to be healed by Jesus, finding out where he is, lining the people up in the marketplaces and begging, please, let them touch a piece of your clothing. But Jesus is so much more than a healer, far more than that. He's God in the flesh. But the crowds don't have eyes to see who is passing by as he goes through their towns. I started by attempting to wake us up a little bit from the apathy and the contempt of familiarity we have with this text. That stands as the first application of the text. The text is trying to point us in the direction and make us ask the question, who is this? Who is this water walker? Nobody walks on water. None in humanity except one has walked on water. So why? How? What does that mean about that one? The disciples, bone-tired, frustrating with rowing all night, get a glimpse, or they think they get a glimpse of something on the water. I'm sure they shook their head or wiped the rain out of their eyes or whatever, or the wind out, and wiped their eyes and took another look, and then they think it's a ghost, and they're afraid. And then Jesus gets closer and says, no, it's me. Take heart. Do not be afraid, and gets in the boat with them. And what should the disciples say? What should we say? We should say, and they should say, oh, that's no ghost. That's my God. In verse 51, note that the disciples were utterly astounded, or they were utterly amazed beyond measure. This is their response when Jesus gets in the boat. This being overwhelmed with amazement. Yet Mark goes on to note that they had not understood what Jesus had done and what it meant about him when he fed the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish. They didn't get it. They didn't understand. Something was impeding their understanding. However, Matthew chapter 14, verse 33 lets us know that this utter astonishment that is mentioned here by Mark actually is expressed in worship and acknowledging Jesus as the Son of God. So they actually worship Jesus once he gets in the boat. And they call him the Son of God, though, as Mark notes here, they're doing it imperfectly. They're doing it without full understanding of what they're saying or doing. But that's the whole point of the text. It's to push us, who is this water walker? And the answer comes back, he's God in the flesh, walking by. It pushes us to acknowledge his divinity and to worship him. The second application is taken from the context that Jesus came to the disciples in the darkness, in the night, in the toil and the strain of the disciples. It's easy for us in our minds and in our troubles to just focus on our troubles, to just focus on the things that are bothering us or overwhelming us. And we miss Jesus' passing us by. We miss his presence with us in the darkness, in the troubles. We miss him revealing himself to us in our pain. I'd like you to turn to Revelation chapter 1, last book of the New Testament. We'll start at verse 12 and read to verse 18. So the Apostle John is having a vision from God. Verse 12, then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Fear not, I am the first and the last, and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades." So John is able to see in a vision the resurrected Christ, the resurrected Jesus, ascended with all authority and power, and his divinity, of course, is showing through his resurrected body. So John's searching for words or ways to describe him. And Jesus' feet isn't actually burnished bronze. His eyes aren't actually fire. Notice all the like this. He's just trying to describe the awesomeness of the divinity of God coming through Jesus in his resurrected body. The point I want you to note is that he's among seven lampstands. What are those lampstands? Those lampstands, fortunately, it's a symbol. They're not real lampstands. They're a symbol of something, and we're told what that is in verse 20. Verse 20 says that the seven golden lampstands and the seven lampstands are the seven churches, right at the end of verse 20. And these seven churches are mentioned in chapter 2 and 3 of Revelation. And God is appearing to John, and he says, "I've got some words, I got some messages that I want you to give to these seven churches." But the image is, Jesus is among the seven churches. That's the whole vision. Let's briefly summarize these churches. Ephesus, they're patiently enduring, they're working hard, they're toiling, testing those who claim to be apostles or claim to be people from God and sorting out the false ones from the true ones, but they've forgotten their first love. You've got Smyrna. They have a lot of trouble. They're poor, and they're told they're going to undergo a severe persecution. Pergamon, they live where Jesus describes as where Satan dwells, and they're persecuted, but they're faithful. But he says, you have false teachers among you, and you have false teaching, and you need to deal with that. And then Thyatira, they're patient, they have love, they have faith and service, but also they too are compromising. They are compromising in the area of sexual immorality and false teaching, and they need to deal with that. And then the church at Sardis, God says, you're almost dead. Then Philadelphia, they're persecuted, but they're not denying God. And he says, I will give you an open door and nobody can shut. I'm going to give you this opportunity. So grasp it, take it. And to Laodicea, the lukewarm church, the one that's confident, thinking that because of their own works and their own abilities and their own possessions, they think they're rich and a glorious church. He says to them, you're nothing but a pitiful, naked, blind group of church or people. You're not at all like what you think. So, where is Jesus the water walker with these churches, in relation to these churches from Revelation? Where are they? Jesus the water walker is among the churches. He's among the lampstands. That's the picture here. He's not far away from the churches. He's among them. And he's with them in all their troubles, in all their filth, in all their victories, in all their failures. And Jesus is among his lampstands, among his churches, among his people to aid, to rescue, to protect, to discipline, to judge, to prune, etc., etc. He's there among us here. Jesus is passing by us in our storms. He's passing by us in our life. Do we have eyes to see him, ears to hear what he's saying to us, or are we missing him? Ask the song leader to come.